I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about renewed US sanctions against political and business leaders in Zimbabwe. What will they achieve? An upsurge in fighting in the oil-rich Cabo Delgado region of Mozambique is forcing ever more people out of their homes.
In the past 2 months, there have been more than 110,000 displaced people in areas where already in the past 6 years, people have been affected by multiple displacement, and people are fleeing to save their lives.
And urgent questions for the people and politicians of Europe from the man who inspired an Oscar-nominated film on undocumented migration.
Why in Africa today, to travel, we are obliged to face the desert, the Mediterranean Sea. The question is why? But the European people, when they want to go to Africa, they need 1 day to take the visa and they just travel. So this movie is to say enough is now.
It's Thursday, the 7th of March. First, we go to Harare. The United States has just imposed new sanctions against Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, his wife, and other senior leaders, including his deputy, Constantino Chiwenga. Other sanctions were in place before these, from the US and also from the UK. So sanctions are not new to Zimbabwe. And it hasn't stopped companies in the UK like Anglo American and Unilever from doing business with Harare. So what are these new sanctions from the US meant to achieve? They are enacted under something called the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act, which authorizes the US to sanction foreign government officials for corruption and human rights offenses. Under these sanctions, individuals are subject to asset freezes and travel bans. So let's get back to what the sanctions are meant to achieve, and more broadly, what effect have previous sanctions have on the people and the economy of Zimbabwe?
Life in Zim is very, very complicated. You know, there's those that are making it work and who are lucky enough to be, you know, to be making their lives a bit comfortable. But I think for the majority of people, it's a struggle. And the struggle is mostly based on the financial side of things. You know, there's like a very high level of unemployment in the country. And the majority of the citizens, they basically survive on informal trading on the streets. We have one of the very highest informal working sectors, I think, globally. There's not really a lot of jobs that are absorbing recent graduates that are coming out of colleges and universities. That's why a lot of younger people prefer getting passports and leaving the country. It's very challenging. There's so many issues, electricity, power cuts, and in some cities, there's a lack of service delivery, which is punctuated by water shortages, like in the second city of Bulawayo. Jobs are hard to come by, things are expensive, there's like a high level of inflation, but Zimbabweans are very hardworking, and in all the struggles, they always find ways of making things ends meet.
To look at the issue in more depth, Terence Chitapi, a political economy scholar and human rights activist from Zimbabwe, has been explaining. Tell us about these latest sanctions. What do they sanction and who do they sanction?
Yeah, so the latest sanction under the Global Magnitsky targets certain individuals within the Zimbabwean government, as well as a few business people who have been linked to issues around corruption and abuse of human rights, as well as money laundering from the state of Zimbabwe.
Can you name them for us, please?
Whilst I don't have the full list with me, I know the president and the first vice president, Constantino Chiwenga, are on that list, as well as the first lady. I also know that there is a prominent business person who is linked to the ruling ZANU-PF party. Kudakwashe Tagwire is also on that list.
Now, I know that you're not in the mind of the United States government, but why did they impose these sanctions and why now?
You actually find that there is a simmering debate that is going on in mostly the Western capitals around an increasing kleptocracy, you know, that is growing globally, you know, and that is really linked to the laundering of illicit funds from African countries, including Zimbabwe, ruling elites and their business associates from the continent, siphoning funds from state coffers in Africa. And these monies have increasingly found their way into the global financial circuits, you know, of mostly the Western countries, the UK, the United States itself. And I think this is part of efforts to stem that flow of illicit finances from the African continent.
There's also a travel ban, I believe, on the president, so he can't travel to the US on unofficial business. He can go there for UN meetings and so on. But what's the effect of those sanctions, both in terms of the morale of the people and also on the economy?
What we see, I think, with these kind of sanctions, for as long as they are coming through unilateral means being imposed by one country, unlike other sanctions, which we see that multilateral and a result of a number of countries working together, they seem to have less effect and impact, and they always give room, you know, for those that are being sanctioned to wriggle themselves out of the public glare and scrutiny, you know, of what really is informing the imposition of these sanctions versus the realities on the ground.
You're saying that the sanctions Yes. have the opposite effect of what they're meant to achieve, which is accountability and proper governance and the end to impunity. What happens? What's the response when they do that?
Governments always cry sanctions, you know, as a reason for them not being able to meet those obligations of providing public goods and services. I think this is what their propaganda has actually managed to do, even beyond the borders of Zimbabwe, to the extent that regional blocs like SADC actually been aiding their voice to say sanctions on Zimbabwe must be removed, but without then going on to say the government of Zimbabwe must also be accountable in terms of provision of public goods and services.
Let's talk about the morale of the people when these sanctions are imposed, mm-hmm. and also what's the effect that it has on the economy of the people, because that is what government says, that it's affecting the economy. Does it affect the economy?
Of course it does. They do, you know, prohibit US banks from extending lines of credit and loans to the Zimbabwean government. They also allow for asset freezes of assets in the United States belonging to certain individuals and entities. And naturally, these can impact, you know, how businesses in Zimbabwe that are linked to certain individuals operate. And this is by nature the way that sanctions operate. So naturally, any sanctions has this effect of diminishing the prospect of businesses and individuals from trading with them. This obviously has the effect of affecting how citizens enjoy or can be able to access public goods and services.
Remind us of all the sanctions that Zimbabwe is currently under. Because these are just the latest sanctions from the US, but there were sanctions before when President Mugabe was still the president, when he was still alive. And the UK also has sanctions on Zimbabwe, even though they still trade with the country.
Yeah, so you actually find that these sanctions, they've over time changed. You know, I think initially we were told that these were smart sanctions, restrictive measures. But what we have seen progressively is that the EU, the UK, and other Western countries have been sort of relaxing, you know, these sanctions to the extent that even in their presence, some of these countries have continued to do business and to trade with them, with Zimbabwe. And I think it was only the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, which has been maintained, you know, to the extent that it had the same effects at its inception up to now.
The impact of the sanctions, would you say that it's quite severe on people, their morale, and on their ability to create a sustainable life for themselves?
The ordinary person in a country like Zimbabwe, for example, cannot easily open a PayPal account, you know, because of restrictions emanating from the effects of these sanctions. You know, it's very difficult, you know, to send money from within Zimbabwe to outside. It's also very difficult for businesses within Zimbabwe to access lines of credit, you know, from foreign banks. These are things that generally demoralize allies, you know, the people.
How does it affect Zimbabwe's relationships with countries like China and Russia? Because the diamonds, for instance, in Zimbabwe have been developed by countries other than Zimbabwe's previous trade partners, right?
Yes. The world is very globalized and so many countries trade with each other. And once some countries do not limit the flow of goods or minerals from Zimbabwe into them, and those countries have got free trading relations with other countries, then my guess is as good as yours. Though the very same entities and goods that are supposed to be sanctioned will eventually find their way into those countries that are imposing those sanctions.
Terence, thank you so much. It's been very interesting talking to you about this.
You're welcome, Audrey.
Terence Chitape, political economy scholar and human rights activist from Zimbabwe. The government has condemned these fresh sanctions, saying that the accusations were defamatory and a gratuitous slander against Zimbabwe's leaders and its people. We are in Mozambique now, and I don't know if you remember, but back in March 2020, we reported on a massive insurgent attack on government installations in the gas-rich province of Cabo Delgado. That insurgency began in 2017, and in the months and years that followed, around 4,000 people, civilians and security personnel included, have died in the fight against a group popularly known as Al-Shabaab. Please note, they are not necessarily affiliated to the Somali outfit of the same name. The Mozambican group is more properly known as Ansar al-Sunna. Rwandan troops came in to help the Mozambicans fight the insurgency. And then, bolstered by troops from the Southern African Development Community, Mozambique was able to retake towns and villages captured by the insurgents in recent years. But now, the violence has flared up again. Some 100,000 people have fled their homes in the past 2 months alone, according to aid organizations. This includes at least 70 children who have gone missing, and there are fears that they could have been kidnapped by the militants. Francesca Zuccaro is the deputy head of mission for Doctors Without Borders, and she gave us a snapshot of the situation.
People are fleeing their houses, their homes, their villages out of fear, but also to save their lives. So at the moment, we are talking about over 650,000 displaced people, of which around 110, 115 by now, are newly displaced in the last 2 months, and over 500,000 are people that have been displaced in the past years, some of them being displaced since 2020. So the needs are, of course, huge for all of them and for the newly displaced families that are just running for their life.
Fernando Lima is a political commentator and editor at Zitama News in Maputo. We began our conversation by him telling me what he thought could have happened to the missing children.
We have two clues on the situation. One, the disappearance of these children, it happened in southern Cabo Delgado when the population flee 2 weeks ago on horrible attacks by insurgents in Shudi district. So since families move across the Luri River to Nampula province in a hurry, a number of children disappear. Another explanation, including from yesterday, is that there is an ongoing military offensive in central Cabo Delgado while the insurgent groups are withdrawing from the south of Mozambique back to their bases in central Mozambique. And eventually, they are using children that they kidnapped from schools. They are taking these children to use as human shields in their way up to their bases in Macomia district. But the use of children and the kidnapping of children, it happened all the time because they want to train children and also indoctrinate them in religious doctrines.
Right. More than 100,000 people fled their homes after attacks. These attacks had stopped for a while. We didn't hear too much about fighting in Cabo Delgado for quite a while. What is going on now?
The imminence of Total Energies to announce the lifting of the force majeure status for the gas fields areas and the development of their industrial site in northern Cabo Delgado. I think it have prompted those attacks and the ongoing offensive both in central Cabo Delgado and in southern Cabo Delgado.
For the benefit of our listeners, just tell us a little bit about what force majeure is. I can tell them that Cabo Delgado is an area that is very rich in oil and gas, and Total is the company, the French company, that is going to be exploiting those resources. But just tell us what the force majeure is and how it came into effect.
In March 2021, when Total Energies was about to start the industrial project, Palma, where the project is located onshore, was attacked. So this prompted Total to declare force majeure for the area and the project, which the project and all foreign technicians and national technicians have been taken out of the site. Since then, Total continues to work there, but in a very low-profile manner, while expecting to lift force majeure, which is having the project to work in full force, which was about to happen in this first quarter of 2024.
Because force majeure is an insurance term and it's very technical. Just explain to us what it is.
It's a term that implies also legal implications. This means that this as relates to the relations between Total Energies, its partners, and the contractors for the project. So when force majeure is declared, a number of indemnities will not be used or placed in action due to this, the fact that there were events, extraordinary events, that prevent those contractors to move ahead with the contracts they have signed.
Now, the fallout of those events in Palma in 2021 was that the Mozambican army was supported by African troops, Rwandan troops, and also troops from South Africa. The Rwandan troops, I think, were a unilateral agreement, but the others were as part of the SADC deployment. They've been there, and it seemed like they were effective in containing the insurgency. Are they still there now?
Yes, they are still there, but their status differs. While the Rwandan force is mainly protecting the two key districts where the gas project should take place, meaning Mutsimba da Praia and Palma, those areas remain calm and safe. In the other areas protected by the SADC force are in what I would say in a transitional phase, meaning SADC forces are supposed to leave in July this year. And in anticipation of that situation, they are not being too active on the ground, especially the South African contingent, which is the main force within SADC. The explanation is related to the fact that the South African contingent is about to be withdrawing from Mozambique.
Tell us about the insurgents. Who are they and what do they want?
Well, very interesting question. Those insurgents start their activities in October 2017, and they proclaim themselves as jihadist fighters fighting for a certain interpretation of Islam and fighting the government of Mozambique. But also it should be said that this is an area where there is a lot of poverty. This kind of groups, they have the right field to grow and spread their activities in this particular province. And of course, as you probably know, there are also suggestions that there is a strong move from outside of Mozambique financing the group. And these days, it's Islamic State's media outlets that promote every single attack that have been taken by those insurgents inside Cabo Delgado. So since they proclaimed alliance to Daesh, the Islamic State.
Do you think that now that this is happening, that SADC will consider staying in Mozambique?
no decision taken, but yes, this is one of the possibilities, while the Rwandan contingent could be reinforced in order to address the fragilities that have been shown by Mozambican security forces in recent weeks.
Fernando Lima, political commentator and editor at Zitama News in Maputo. The Italian movie Io Capitano is an epic tale of a young man's journey from Senegal to Italy. That young man is Mamadou Kwasi, and his story made it to the top 5 international feature films at the Oscars this year, and I believe it's a firm favorite to win. Mamadou is Ivorian and an activist for the rights of undocumented migrants. The Italian director that made the film is Matteo Garrone, best known for award-winning films like Gomorra. That film is a fictional exposé based on real events depicting the impact of organized crime in southern Italy and a community's attempts to fight back. But back to Io Capitano and the man who inspired the film.
I'm Mamadou Kwasi from Ivory Coast. I'm living in Italy more than 15 years ago, and I inspired together with some migrants the story of Io Capitano. This film is talking about the real fact that we face in the desert, that we see in the Mediterranean Sea, even in the prison. So nothing is fake, it's the reality. And I'm proud for the job that the director did together with the migrants to make people understand and know what we face really before arriving in Europe.
Mum, I have to tell you something.
Go ahead, I'm listening.
I want to leave and go and work abroad. I want to work in Europe, so I can help you out.
Who's put this idea into your head? I don't need you to leave. You have to stay here and breathe the same air as me.
I was trying to tell my mother to see if she would be agree. The intention that she showed to me means that they know that many people are dying in the desert and in the Mediterranean Sea. The warmness of the family is important for us. So to leave from your family and go to other places, it's not easy sometimes to leave your child, to leave the country like this. Our parents, our mothers are afraid. They know, they really know that people that are trying to make the journey, most of the time, they do not arrive. We do hear in on the news in Africa, in the newspapers, in the televisions, that is the hardest way to reach in Europe.
Seydou, you don't want to do this anymore? 6 months we've been preparing. Europe is waiting for us. You're becoming a big star. Europeans will be asking you for your autograph. You'll go on stage like a real star.
The journey is that one step, and as soon as you enter in Europe, is another story, another hard story to be told, to let people understand after the journey, there is another journey in Europe that is harder. It is important that people, after the journey, they understand that what is going in Europe, the image of Europe that we used to see, is not heaven. Many parts of the film has been removed like the violence way, but for me, I'm agreed for the choice of the director. Because today, let me see, in Italy, most of the students are watching the film since September. They are still watching the film. So all the schools are screening the film to let the students see the story, understand what migrants faces before coming to Europe.
That's not even enough money for one person's channel crossing.
That's all I have.
Here, come back when you have enough.
Please help me. That's all my cousin and I have, and he's injured. We really have to leave.
Listen, I have a solution. If you pilot the boat, you can both leave for the price of one.
I've never done that. I don't even know how to swim.
It's very easy. In one day, you'll be in Italy.
Me and Matteo, we met through one journalist that was Matteo's friend, Annalisa Camilli. I went to Rome to speak about migration matter, so story, and there I narrate my story in front of her, and she listened to my story, and I said, okay. So he gave my number to Matteo Garrone, and 2020 is from there that everything started. This is to bring awareness to the youth, saying that this is a journey that is harder, it's difficult, don't try it. We know that it will not stop the young people that are looking for better life. But at the same time, it's an instrument for the politician to change the policy. Why in Africa today, to travel, we are obliged to face the desert, the Mediterranean Sea? The question is why? But European people, when they want to go to Africa, they need one day to take the visa and they just travel. We some time even to get the appointment, they will not even give you the appointment to go to the embassy. So this movie is to say enough is now. It should be this instrument through the field to open the eyes of politicians from our European people, but at the same time also because if there is good policy, it will help to fight against human trafficking. I will go to Africa also next 2 months to make the screen with the youth. I'm sure that they will ask me many questions because if today I did it and I've been taking myself, gotten this privilege to explain to them that this is what we face, it means that I cannot tell them to stop their dream, but to have a policy that gives them the chance also to travel like the other people. For example, I'm in Los Angeles here. I came here there about 3 weeks. I'm not going to stay here because the life is here is harder. Within after the Oscar, I go back to where I come from. So if people are able to travel to see the situation of the place, really they will see and go back to where they are coming from. This is the reason why we want them to change the policy, give chance to everybody to travel free all over the world.
I'm calling the Maltese Coast Guards. No answer. I also called the Italian Coast Guards, but they said you're not in their territorial waters.
I've been waiting for hours. You don't want to come?
I've been calling for hours too, but there's no answer. I'm really sorry.
I feel proud, but at the same time, I feel like an icon to people, to migrants, today to be able to share the part of the journey that people, most of the time, they did not know the journey. So for me, it was important to present this part together with the director, that he helped us to make the whole world view what we passed through to the desert. So for me, it's the privilege to become a servant for those people that could not make the journey. And through this voice that I got from the director, it's a privilege to broadcast the news and help that maybe from step by step, we can change the world. We can change the view, the mentality of people.
Mamadou Kwasi, the man behind the story told in Io Capitano by director Matteo Garrone. The film has been nominated for an Oscar this year. Focus on Africa was put together by Alfonso Daniels, Yvette Twagira Maria, and Lola Schroyer. Sunita Nahar kept the show on the road. Our technical producer Chris Kuzaris made sure we got on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
What stories would you like to share with your daughter? What does she need to know to help her navigate her life ahead? Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. And it's back for a new series, with more of your letters and more fantastic guests. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.